This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
Well, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to share with you. And I'm going to start off by sharing my story, kind of how I got involved in this from a different aspect than Rusty or Steve. But Steve mentioned that in Southern California you can do anything by car, and that's true. There's actually, you may be familiar with, quite a number of drive-in churches, and I once had the opportunity to share about the rest of the drive-in church, and I got to say that was probably the most surreal experience of my life. It was the morning service, and there was only about six cars in the parking lot. There's a stage at one end of the parking lot, and kind of a backstage. They fitted me up with a microphone. Walk out on stage, and this is playing over the radio in the cars, and so you can't actually hear yourself amplified. You're just talking. You can't see anybody because the sun was reflecting on all the windshields. So, and they started off with some worship music. All the backing music for that was also going through the radio, so I couldn't hear any of that. I was singing a cappella to this parking lot with about six cars, and it was... Talk about being off your game. But I found out later they actually had a moment where everybody was supposed to greet one another. And I saw the people in the service for the first time and realized that it does make a lot of sense for maybe people who aren't as mobile. I did see the sense in it. But I also saw a lot of people get out of their pajamas and that sort of thing.
That's right. I'll get each other.
Well, you know, as I mentioned the other day, my background actually was in political science. I was an officer in the Navy, served for 7 years as a surface warfare officer. I thought that the communist threat was probably the biggest thing facing us in the world at the time. But in my last years in the Navy, I got a master's degree in international relations at University of San Diego. And in order to complete that degree, I needed a foreign language, and I had like a term of Russian here and a term of Arabic over there, and realized I was never going to meet my language requirement that way, so I went to Guatemala for the summer to study Spanish in immersion course. And God met me in a way that I was completely not expecting, opened my eyes to issues of poverty and justice and faith. Lived in a radical way that I hadn't experienced before. Growing up in Southern California, it's very easy, at least I find, to reduce your faith to praying for a parking place. And having grown up in the church, that was sort of my orientation. When people talk about the adventure of the Christian life, I hadn't really seen it. In Guatemala, I saw people living that adventure. The Civil War was still in its waning days, and I met one Guatemalan pastor up in Quiche, who told me stories of having the rebels in his front yard and the army in his backyard and their house in the crossfire, he and his wife making tortillas and then going out and praying with each of the soldiers. And I was stunned by this, you know, this fearlessness and this love and this, and people dealing with poverty. I saw for the first time what I'm sure many of you have seen, but children living in the city dump, making their living picking trash. And my view on what it meant to be a Christian was completely changed. I came back to San Diego at the end of my time, and about that time I was first introduced to Tony Campolo, and many of you are probably familiar with Tony Campolo, but one phrase sticks in my mind. He was talking about giving your life to work for the poor, and he said, you can go, and at the end of that time, you'll have nothing. But you'll be heroes. And who wants to work for IBM when you can be a hero? Boy, that was just the kind of thing, especially coming out of the Navy, that's just the kind of thing I wanted to hear. So I looked for a place to plug in, a place to volunteer, and found myself at Floresta just because it happened to be in San Diego. Now, Floresta was both doing the humanitarian work and the environmental work. I wasn't really comfortable with the environmental work so much. In fact, I remember really early on, my father talked to me and said, I'm not really sure what you're doing with your life. I mean, planting trees for Jesus seems like about as marginal as you can get. And I wasn't so sure that that he was wrong. In fact, I used to cringe. This was 15 years ago, 16 years ago, as people would talk about creation care. Remember, EEN put out a big packet of materials for sermons that pastors were supposed to preach. And I don't really get this. Isn't that going to take away from what the gospel is really about? Thankfully, for us, the people who founded it about 8 years before I got here had a much broader vision, with probably a more utilitarian vision. Getting a little bit ahead of myself, but Floresta was founded in the Dominican Republic in 1985 by a group of relief volunteers and actually a bunch of IFES or InterVarsity people in the Dominican Republic who were involved in giving out food aid and began to realize that the root problems that was requiring the food aid weren't being met. That they're handing out food to the same people day in and day out, and their basic situation wasn't changing. And so they began to look upstream, both figuratively and literally, and came to a rather startling conclusion that deforestation and environmental degradation were key causes to poverty. So they developed the organization to combat both deforestation and poverty simultaneously, looking at that vicious cycle. You know, the other day, was it yesterday? Yeah, yesterday, somebody talked about why this is not more of a mainstream issue. And I was been reflecting on that a little bit. I think one of the things I've learned is that if people saw the state of the world, the state that our planet is in, if we had knowledge of what we were facing, that this room would be full, that this would be possibly the issue. It would be full of Christians recognizing that creation is growing, and it would be full of non-Christians recognizing that we have hope, because the more you dig into the state of the world, the more tempted one is to despair. And yet we know that we have hope in Jesus Christ. So we have something to offer to the environmental community that they are desperately searching for. I used to have a colleague, a guy who worked with us at Floresta, and that's how he came to Christ. As an environmental studies major, he was faced with despair and was searching for a hope which he could only find in Jesus. And I think that's a message we need to share. But we also need to learn more about creation so that we can see its state and see that it's growing. I think another reason that people aren't here is because they don't see what's going on, as Rusty said, off screen, that this is a justice issue. It's a justice issue in Kentucky, but it's a justice issue in Haiti, and it's a justice issue in Sub-Saharan Africa, and it's a justice issue in Mexico, and in South America, and in Asia, and around the world. What I became aware of in Guatemala was the forgotten poor. And we are, let's see if I can remember. We are getting better at seeing the poor around the world. We're familiar with urban poverty, maybe. And certainly you look at that, and it's hard to not see an environmental issue there. But I think even beyond that, even more out of sight and out of mind, are the rural poor. You know, the 840 million million chronically hungry people in the world. 80% of those are the rural poor. But they tend to be off of all of our radar. You know how these are statistics everybody I'm sure knows, but they bear reiterating. 1.4 billion people in the world live on less than $1.25 a day. One in every two people in the world live on less than $2.50 a day. One in every two people in the world lives on less than $2.50 a day. 840 million people, as I say, chronically hungry. 80% of those are rural poor. Nearly a billion people make their living as subsistence farmers around the world. This picture actually happens to come from Haiti. You know, for a long time, people didn't understand the connection between poverty and deforestation. I've sensed a growing awareness, and sadly, Haiti tends to be the one example that everybody can think of. It's sort of the poster child for what we do. You know, I think some of this awareness is changing. Some of, like I say, people are more aware of the connection between deforestation and poverty. In the 15 years that I've been doing this, the first 13 years, I would talk to people, and they just wouldn't get it. And in Christian circles, frequently they would give me a hard time. I would hear, you like what you're doing with helping the poor, but you got to do the trees. And, you know, in the last 3 years, that's changing. It's changing slowly. You know, I keep expecting. We're all, I think, still waiting for the conference when we get 200 people or 500 people. We're still talking to small groups. But it's changing, and that's exciting, and then it's gratifying. Well, let me tell you a little bit about the connection we've seen between deforestation and poverty, how it works. There we go. What we had discovered was this vicious cycle between deforestation and poverty, people caught with no alternatives. And so people who were poor were forced into a cycle where they had to exploit the land in order to survive. And in so doing, deforesting it and the deforestation leading to further poverty. And I'll talk a little bit about how those work together, how poverty contributes to deforestation. The first is through charcoal and fuel wood. That's something that, again, is off of our radar screen. We think of oil and coal, but in a large portion of the world, their energy comes from charcoal and fuel wood. In some sub-Saharan African countries, 98% of the energy is generated from charcoal or from fuel wood. Share with you a family I met in, this is in a town in Oaxaca, a place called La Maria, and about 400 people high in the mountains outside of Oaxaca City sat down with the mayor, and he explained to me that the only economic product that they had ever produced was charcoal. That was it. They grew corn and beans for their own consumption, but if they wanted any money for school fees or for to buy anything, for clothes, etc., it was made through charcoal, but that was their number one source of income. Here you can see a whole family working, making charcoal. They made about, I talked to them at some length, and they made about $240 a year making charcoal, and as you can see, the whole family is involved. Interestingly enough, it's not for their own consumption. It's not even for rural consumption. The charcoal they make is bagged and sold in the city. That's the primary fuel of the city. It's more expensive than just straight firewood, which is what the rural poor themselves can use. Anyways, another view of the family there in La Maria. Next door to La Maria, there was another town, a town called El Porvenir. It's about 10 miles away. And they didn't have, El Porvenir roughly translates to the future. And that was kind of interesting. La Maria making their living from the charcoal 10 miles away. There's another town known sort of as the future. And here is what El Porvenir looks like. Used to be pine and oak forest only 40 or 50 years ago. You can imagine, try and put yourself in that situation. Living there, you inherit maybe a couple acres of that land, and that's where you make your living. Of course, La Maria doesn't get their primary income from charcoal anymore. El Porvenir doesn't get their primary income from charcoal anymore. They actually get their primary income from remittances sent from the United States. And if you talk to the people there, they will tell you that the population is about 800, but only 300 or 400 of them are there most of the time. The rest they only see maybe at Christmas or when they go pick up their checks. The other big way that poverty contributes, lack of opportunity contributes to deforestation, I'll back up here since I can do that with the wheel, is through slash and burn agriculture. This picture's in Chiapas, a field that had been cleared, rotating or migratory agriculture, so-called Swidden agriculture, with population pressure, and as the poor get pushed into more and more marginal lands, mountainsides and hillsides, it becomes less and less sustainable. And then land gets converted to cattle grazing. Now, lest you think this connection between poverty and deforestation is only occurs in Mexico and Haiti. This is tropical deforestation worldwide. As you can see, smallholder agriculture contributes 35% to 45%. Logging and cattle pasture are much smaller. The other includes the charcoal and fuel wood. So just going to index hotel. The other side of that cycle is the deforestation makes those poor people poorer through soil erosion. If you think about a poor farmer, the only thing that they have, the only assets that they really can count on is their soil and their water. And when you cut the trees, both of those tend to go away. Soil erosion dramatically increases. The springs and rivers dry up, aquifers dry. The trees provide a natural purification system, and that goes away. And so your water goes away. The rainfall actually becomes much less regular. You lose the only asset you have. One of the things, again, coming to this as a reluctant environmentalist, it was easy for me to discount these things. Okay, it's really not having that big an impact. I was asked to give a presentation on the health effects of deforestation. And to me, it was obvious that you know, if you lose your soil and your water becomes contaminated, that's going to have some pretty dramatic health effects. But what I was unaware of was connections to infectious disease, relationships between deforestation and malaria, deforestation being one of the primary variables in the incidence of leishmaniasis and hookworm. And when fuel wood becomes scarcer, becomes more expensive, people stop cooking their food as much. They stop boiling their water. So cascading effects. And of course, catastrophic effects. I think I took the slide out here, but some of the landslides that we've had. Well, I've got some coming up. So I didn't see that. But landslides that are connected to deforestation are one of the more well-known effects. This slide just illustrates, and take some moment to look at that, but illustrates what happens, the bottom slide, when the land is forested, the water has time to infiltrate the soil, the aquifers are recharged, the wells actually have water in them, the trees are cut, everything runs off, including the soil, and wells dry up. You know, one of the things that I notice is that we spend a lot of time, and I see real good changes in the church, and more emphasis on dealing with poverty and social justice, but one of the things is we spend a lot of time thinking about well drilling. How are we going to respond to the poor? Well drilling, well drilling. Let's take it one step further back and respond by protecting the watersheds and maintaining the water supplies that people have. One of the exciting things at Florestas, we've actually, through reforestation, seen rivers and streams that had dried up start to come back and start to flow year-round. And I believe that that's part of God's plan of redemption, using us, or actually using the poor themselves, to redeem the land. Just a slide illustrating some of the challenges with water. A lot of the communities where we are working, this is happens to be in Haiti, are several hours from the nearest water supply. It doesn't show up real well on this slide, but I came to the top of that hill and kind of got vertigo as I was going down it. all the while, elderly women and little children are coming up with 5-gallon buckets on their head. And the first thought that comes to people's mind is, well, why did they build the community so far from the water? When they built the community, the water probably wasn't that far away. And in fact, we've seen a huge correlation between the availability of water and the deforestation. Now, one of the things that people tend to ask is, well, why don't you just tell people? If they just knew what was happening when they were cutting the trees, they'd stop. One of the things that I've seen is that desperation, lack of opportunity, trumps education. This is a quote from a Honduran farmer, but we've heard this over and over again. In Haiti, after the landslides in 2003, the newspaper article talked about how the landslides were directly related to deforestation, and then ended with this very hopeless note saying, but until the economy turns around, the deforestation will continue. They interviewed some charcoal vendor who said, I know all about the deforestation and the landslides, but how else can I feed my family? Like somebody shared earlier, when people, it's the only way people have to feed their economy or feed their families. It's the basis of the economy. What else can they do? In fact, one of the stories that has always stuck with me is the story of a farmer in Haiti during the time of drought. His house was surrounded by mango and avocado trees, but the drought was so extended and his situation was so dire that he actually cut down all his fruit trees to sell as firewood because he couldn't wait for the fruit to ripen and for the harvest to come. And if that doesn't point out the fact that desperation trumps education. I've had Haitian farmers explain how a watershed works to me better than I've had American biology teachers. They know. They just don't have other opportunities. Am I using up my time? All right. Well, I'll wind up real quick. So the question then is, how do we respond? And the temptation that we have, I think, is to want to prescribe and tell people what they should do and give people things if they just had more things. That's why I call this the best of intentions. This is a bulldozer donated by an American church. It's almost brand new. It's sitting in a church yard down in Haiti, and it actually is providing a pretty good planter for some of the trees there. So we try and respond, and I really think that it's important for us. As one lesson the church needs to learn is it's important to respond by empowering the local church and the local people. God has given everybody talents, and the tendency is to come in and play God in the lives of the poor, to say, we know what is best for you, and to simply help them bury their talents deeper instead of helping them to realize their talents, dig those up, and put them to use. These are the tools that we use, empowerment, helping people to discover their talents and to set their own agenda, innovative agriculture and forestry, some of the things that have been done there. Microfinance, so that people have other opportunities. People who are renting their land or sharecropping can buy their land and invest in its long-term future. Discipleship. This is one story I want to share. Church we work with, a bunch of churches we work with in Africa. This is the so-called half-mile strip or community-managed forest outside the Kilimanjaro National Park, on the side of Kilimanjaro. You can see what shape it's in. I actually shared this slide at a conference on faith and the environment in Kenya. There are about 500 Kenyan pastors there. And a couple of Tanzanian pastors that had come up with us. And one of them came up to me afterwards and he was so embarrassed. He said, you showed that slide. And I realized, that's us. That's the land that God has given us to take care of. And so he went back, Lutheran pastor, went back and talked to all the other pastors in the area. Now we have 20 plus churches with tree nurseries. 20 plus churches that students going through their confirmation classes, have to plant trees. They planted 300,000 or 400,000 trees, those churches, because they've got a vision for it. Another thing I think is that there's a real role for international pastors who don't have some of the American political hang-ups to bring this message of creation care back to us. I think that's one of the things that by showing the way, by doing that, that these pastors have the opportunity to do. I'd love to get them here to share. Anyway, this sums up sort of what we're trying to do at Floresta, bringing together environmental restoration, economic empowerment, spiritual inspiration, bring about transformation. So the return to El Porvenir, just to make it quick, I'll say that we're going to see that in the video. I wanted to talk about climate change, but maybe I can come back to that after the video.
You want to show the video?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay.
This video, it's got some Floresta propaganda up front, but it's mostly hearing from the farmers, in specifically in Oaxaca and Mexico, about the things that they're doing.
So Sam, in the mid-80s, to get at root problems instead of trying to band-aid or structure insulation, I think that we have developed Floresta into an exciting development organization. It really is getting its most key followers. Floresta has worked in 120 villages worldwide. We're serving thousands of families in Mexico, Haiti, Dominican Republic, Tanzania, and Thailand. We've partnered with the local church to bring renewal and revival to the forgotten countryside. We teach sustainable agriculture, how to farm the land instead of working against the land, using the latest techniques from around the world. We help them diversify their economy by making small business loans, helping them to release their God-given talents. We realize that the poor depended on the environment, that without trees, without the forest, that the soil eroded away and the streams dry up and the poor could no longer make a living. At Floresta, what we're trying to do is take this vicious cycle of deforestation and poverty and replace it with a virtuous cycle of reforestation and economic opportunity. And we believe that with prayer and with discipleship, that has potential to become what we call a victorious cycle.
Oaxaca es una tierra diversa.
I want to leave you with two things. You know, I said that I was part of what brought me into this was Tony Campolo saying you can be heroes. Well, I've learned that maybe that's not so true. That Jesus is the hero of the story. And after that, the poor, the last, becoming the first as God describes His kingdom, they're the heroes of the story. But what we can be is the Hortons. You know the story of Horton? Here's a who. You know? They're here. They're here. We can tell the story. We can be the voice for the voiceless. And that's the role that Horton plays in Horton Hears a Who. And I think I've learned that that's what I get to be. It's not a hero, but a Horton. That's the first thing. And the second thing I want to share with you is the connection between human flourishing and the flourishing of creation is reflected in Scripture, or Scripture tells us about that. And I think one of the most incredible passages is Isaiah 41, verses 17 through 20. And do you have it handy? Can I read it off the thing, or I'll paraphrase otherwise?
You mean it's not there?
This is the very abridged version. Yeah, where God speaking to the prophet Isaiah, it says, "The poor and needy seek water, but there is none, and their tongues are parched with thirst. I, the Lord, will answer them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers on the bare heights and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I'll make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I'll put in the wilderness the cedar and the acacia, the myrtle and the olive. I'll set in the desert the cypress and the plane and the pine together, so that they may see and know may consider and understand that the hand of the Lord has done this. The Holy One of Israel has done it.
What I think is so exciting about this passage is the starting problem is the same place we started. The poor and needy, and they lack water. And God answers them by planting trees and opening springs in the wilderness. To what ultimate end? To His glory. And I think that this, in some small way, we're blessed to be a part of this redemption of creation, this reflourishing of creation, so that the humans in it can flourish to God's glory. Anyway, I have run over my time. That was my alarm that says it's time to go home. So. Anyway, thanks, Scott.